It's The Record. I'm Steve Scher. Supporters of the $15 minimum wage in SeaTac are celebrating victory today. Starting in January, SeaTac will have the highest minimum wage in the nation by over $5. But the movement isn't isolated to this little city. There are initiatives sprouting up across the country, and some airports have already gone the route of raising their minimum wages. Quoctrin Bui is a reporter for NPR's Planet Money. He's been looking at national trends among minimum wage earners. Quoctrin Bui, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, thank you.
So you put out three graphs on Planet Money website about who earns the minimum wage. How'd you break that down?
So basically, there's a distribution, right, of all the workers in the United States that earn the minimum wage. And there's many different ways you can look at them. You can look at them by race. You can look at them by age. You can look at them by gender and the industry in which they work in. So what we did was we just broke it down by each different industry. And then we compared that to what people who earn hourly wages work, what distribution they work in overall. And what we found that there's a huge disproportionate number of people who work in the service industry who earn the minimum wage over all workers generally.
You also found that the minimum wage workers by age in 2012 are mostly young. How did that break down? 16 to 24, it looks like.
Right. And it's actually pretty stark because young people make a very small share of all hourly workers. And they make up a huge sum, a huge share of minimum wage workers.
And thirdly, the third graph that you came up with, Quoctrin Bui, as part of the Planet Money look at minimum wage, were women. Women are the high percentage of women are getting the minimum wage compared to men and compared to hourly workers as a whole.
Yeah, and that, you know, what was surprising about that, I was struck by the share. And when I looked into it, it seems like the disproportion of women earning the minimum wage has to do with the fact that, on average, women earn less than men, for instance. And so if you're comparing two workers on the low end and you have this floor for wages, you're going to have a lot more women earning the bare minimum compared to men.
You know, what's interesting about these questions of the minimum wage is how complicated they are and how economists try to parse these things out. But there are many factors involved in who enters the workforce, when they enter the workforce, and who their competition is as they move through the workforce. As somebody who's looking at this, what did you glean from these graphs that help you understand whether the minimum wage is an efficient tool?
Well, so there's a couple ways to look at it. So the national minimum wage isn't necessarily the most efficient tool because cost of living is different for every state. So when you're setting one price for labor, for instance, for the entire country, there's going to be some winners and some losers. So in Washington State, the cost of living index is a little bit higher than if you lived in, for instance, Alabama. So people in Alabama, if like the national minimum wage went up, they would benefit more in terms of value than people living in Washington State. So that's why you have a lot of states enacting their own state minimum wages that are higher than the federal minimum wage. And then there's a lot of details in terms of whether or not you lose workers on the low end when you impose a higher minimum wage and whether or not the gained benefit of higher wages offsets the lost jobs at the low end.
Yeah, this is what we're going to find out with the SeaTac effort, because at $15 an hour, people may come in from outside the community that haven't competed for those jobs to compete for those 6,000-plus jobs.
Right, because you're going to have a lot more demand for those higher-paying jobs than you did when the minimum wage was lower.
Some airports have gone ahead and done this in other places. Is there something economic we can learn about having a captive space? In other words, we as travelers move into a space where we go behind security. Many of the workers who will be affected by these minimum wage rules are inside that little bubble. Does that teach us something?
It teaches that it's these minimum wage increases within these airports, I don't think they're very indicative of national trends, because the natural way to think about it is when you go to an airport, you expect to pay $10, $11 for a hamburger, and if the price goes up two more dollars before labor income, you're not going to blink. So a lot of travelers are kind of stuck between a rock and, you know, a hard place when they're purchasing goods and services. So in a way, it makes sense because the incentives are there for the city and for the airport to pass on the extra cost of labor to the travelers, because that's what you come to expect when you go to an airport.
Expectation plays a part of it. What happens then? What do you learn from this vote? Do you learn anything about how it might be applied in other places? The city of Seattle's talking about taking a $15 minimum wage citywide.
In terms of like transferring knowledge and experience from an airport, I don't think that you're going to find a very strong relationship there, principally because the way an airport works, as I said before, is people, they're stuck. They have to buy goods and services when they're passing through an airport. If prices are higher in Seattle, for instance, people have the option not to go there.
What's the economic incentive for the leisure industry or the hospitality industry to raise their wages?
Well, for an employer, the way it works is that you want to have the most productive workers available in your place of employment, right? So like right now, we're kind of coming out of a recession. Employment hasn't picked up the way policymakers want it to. You know, the pool of people clamoring for work is still very big. So I think that right now employers don't have any incentive to pay their workers more, because for every worker they lose, they have two or three applicants for the same job. So the incentive right now from an employer standpoint is not very high, unless they have specialized skilled work that they need filled.
Yeah, or a government mandates it.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, that'll be interesting to see as the economy improves, how that changes the way SeaTac and the surrounding businesses respond to that $15 an hour minimum wage.
And I think that the way to think about this is that there only is pressure for a minimum wage when employers aren't paying their workers enough, right? When people feel like the work that they're doing isn't well compensated. If the market's working and employers are paying people what they think they should be paid, there is no political pressure. There is no will to impose a governmental solution.
Kwok-Tun Bui is a reporter for NPR's Planet Money, looking at some of the national trends among minimum wage earners. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.